Chapter 11. The Shell Game. Be sure you know the real decision-makers. Who's calling the shots? Who are the real decision-makers within the adversary's bureaucracy? This might seem, at first glance, to be a fairly mundane issue, but it's not. It's a critically important issue in any negotiation, even though you can read book after book on the subject and never find a single acknowledgement that the question of who's calling the shots demands immediate attention. How can you create vision and paint the pain effectively without knowing who the decision-makers for the adversary really are? You can't, so the decision-making process within your adversary's organization must be discovered and understood at the very beginning of the negotiation or as soon thereafter as possible. If you don't accomplish this, you drive up your time and energy budget, maybe your money budget, and if you're not careful, your emotion budget. As a rule, the bigger the organization, the more complex and confusing the decision-making process can be. When you're dealing with a big multinational, as some of my clients do, solving the shell game can be as frustrating as any aspect of the negotiation. In fact, you will encounter adversaries who play the shell game for just this purpose, to drive up your budget. Now the decision-making is here, now it's there, now it's elsewhere. When was the last time you heard, "Just show me and I'll take it to the board"? Or, "If I like it, I'll recommend it," and they always stamp my recommendations, it's just a formality. "Just put your bid together on the specs and I'll do the rest." But it seldom works out this way, does it? When you stop to think about it, the situation couldn't be this easy. Think of the number of times you as an individual were, in theory, the sole decision-maker regarding a problem, but in the end, ask the opinion and approval of someone else. We do this all the time. In my own family, the loyal dog seems to call the shots much of the time. It's no different for our adversaries. Many times, the adversary does not even know its own decision process as it directly concerns your negotiation. You'll have to help them figure it out. Some experts specialize in analyzing how decision-making differs culturally around the world. In the United States, we supposedly have a vertical process, while in Japan, it's horizontal. I believe that most decision-making structures have both elements, and many surprising twists and turns as well. In my seminars, I sometimes tell the story about the attempted change in the daily training regimen of a major college athletic department. It turned out that this change affected the schedule of the janitorial staff. In fact, the janitorial staff wielded something of a veto over aspects of the schedule. At the least, they had to be brought into the loop. So you never know. But you must know. I'll never forget the episode in which I learned the painful facts of life on this subject. It was back in the 1970s when I recruited on the West Coast for the Ohio State football team. I was working for Woody Hayes, and I cannot tell you how proud I was to do so. We were interested in a wonderful young man and running back named Freeman McNeil, who played high school ball in Los Angeles. All the big football colleges were recruiting Freeman, and I was on this recruit 24/7, as we didn't say then, but might say today. I talked with everyone imaginable, principal, teachers, coaches, family, everyone. Freeman's coach told me that the final decision would be made by Freeman and his family, with the coach's input. So far, so good. When I met Freeman himself, he said he was very interested in Ohio State, and he told me his decision would be based on his assessment of the school and Coach Hayes. Even better, because Woody Hayes was as impressive a man as I ever met. Everyone felt this way. This is a long story, so I'll cut some corners and jump to the weekend when Woody flew to California to meet Freeman. Everything went very well. I was so excited by that evening, all I could see was Freeman scoring for Ohio State against USC in the Rose Bowl. Then, Freeman's mother introduced us to her son's girlfriend, who told Woody and me that she and Freeman had been going steady 2 years. Coach Hayes immediately asked her where she was going to college. She replied, "Why, UCLA." In his most polite and nurturing tone, the old man asked, "What will you study?" Again, she answered with a radiant smile of perfect teeth, "Theater and drama." The evening came to a triumphant end with my believing that Freeman McNeil was going to be the next Heisman Trophy winner for the Ohio State Buckeyes. I was slow. Coach Hayes wasn't. As we walked to the car, he said to me, "Jim, you did a hell of a job with Freeman. You've put us in a great position here in California. But Freeman's going to UCLA." He'd be better off with us, but he'll decide on UCLA. I was flabbergasted. How did Woody know for sure? In response, he asked me, Jim, would you leave home to play for the Buckeyes? Sure. But would you leave your movie star girlfriend alone at UCLA to play for the Buckeyes? That's when I saw the light. I asked Woody when he'd seen it, and he said, not until she said UCLA and theater. That's Hollywood, and that is hard to turn down. Freeman's being recruited by Hollywood and movie stars. He's a fine young man, but the most important part of his decision process is his girlfriend, even if he doesn't realize it. He thinks he's making the decision along with his mom and dad, and he is, but his girl carries the most weight. She'll convince him to go to UCLA, and he'll never see it. If she wanted medicine, law, business, education, we could compete. But she's so damn pretty, and she wants Hollywood. I had not only failed to find all the decision-makers, I had failed to find the main one. In the end, Freeman McNeil did go to UCLA, where he had a very good, if not Heisman Trophy, career. Then he was an All-Pro with the New York Jets, and may someday be in the Professional Football Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio. That failure to find the decision-maker was one mistake I never repeated during my days recruiting for Coach Hayes, but I've seen it committed umpteen times in business negotiations by the adversary, not by the good guys. Recall the negotiation I described in Chapter 9 between my client and the company it was trying to acquire, the one we finally resolved by building the monument to the founder, the widow's husband? With such an inflated price on the table and the negotiations going nowhere, I repeatedly asked the chief negotiator, what the heck is driving this price? He just didn't have a clue, and he's really a bright guy. He was convinced that the board of directors made the decisions, but I did my job as coach and went down with him the list of possible decision-makers. Lawyers? No. Accountants? No. Heirs? He hadn't thought about such potentially important shareholders. Who holds the largest block of stock and has the most influence? He didn't know, but he'd find out. Well, you know the rest of the story. Why do negotiators often fail to find the real decision process? Why do many want to just get a decision, any decision, and get the heck out? One reason, I believe, they fear that they don't have the right behaviors to negotiate with the real decision makers. With my system, however, you do have those behaviors. In this intensely personal, emotionally fraught discovery of who really makes the decisions, your skills with nurturing, reversing, and 3+ will be key. With your mission and purpose in place, and using all your behavioral goals, no matter how elaborate the decision-making process, you can handle it. You simply negotiate each piece of the puzzle until you have the information you need. It's just that simple, if arduous. How do you find out the truth? The same way you find out the truth in any issue in a negotiation. You ask those interrogative-led questions. Of course, you make the decisions, but who else might you want to talk with? Who might be of service in making this decision? Who should we invite to support your decision? Who'd be sorry or upset if we left them out? How will this decision be reached? When will it be reached? What criteria and paperwork must be in place for it to be reached? You need these answers. Eliminate all the wild cards you can think of. Continually ask yourself, who's missing? Who's not in my loop who should be? And be ready for unearthing multiple decision makers, and be able and willing to negotiate with each and every one of them. You'll have to deal with blockers. In many, many instances, the biggest problem you'll encounter in this discovery process is someone on your adversary's team telling you, assuring you, promising you, guaranteeing you that he is the decision maker, when he's not. Why does this happen so often? Quite simply, this is yet another example of how we humans fight to be okay, and it's not okay to say, I have to run everything past my branch manager. It's no exaggeration to state that the decision-making process in an organization is driven by people's need to feel okay. When we walk into a reception area, what's the receptionist fighting for? The feeling of being okay. It's human nature. Who wants to feel powerless? Our big businesses are divided into level after level after level. Upper management, middle management, business development, engineering, legal, human resources. It's endless. We work in these big corporate environments and often we feel like we're about to be swallowed up. We know we're replaceable because we've seen the company plow ahead even if the CEO drops dead. But we want to mean something in this bigger scheme of things. We want to make a beneficial difference. We want to feel okay. And a key way we can do this is to insinuate ourselves into the decision-making process. I call these sweet folks who want to play some kind of role blockers. Beware of them. Once you've determined who the real decision-makers are, it's often hard to get to them because of the blockers standing in the way. If you can't go around or over the blockers, you'll never get your deal. Remember my excellent student, Craig Lemkuhl from Chapter 10? The guy who learned the anxious way that both sides in a negotiation have a budget? His adversaries was so high, the man gladly wrote the check for $50,000. In the early days of Craig's work with me, his biggest problem was getting past the receptionist. This is the situation with lots of people in sales and elsewhere. The blocker could be the receptionist who screens the calls, or the executive assistant, or the co-manager, or worst of all, the person you have incorrectly decided is the decision-maker. Do the blockers think of themselves as blockers? Sometimes yes, because they're under explicit instructions to block. But often, no. They just know what makes them feel okay. They're by nature defensive and believe that their job description is to obstruct forward progress, to create obstacles, and ultimately to bring about your defeat. They may have other reasons for blocking as well. Their jobs might be on the line. They may be jealous because you seem to be the decision maker for your company, while they obviously are not for their own. You're going to get a lot of credit or commissions or some kind of reward for this deal, while they're not. In short, what's in it for the blocker? Maybe not much. Great leaders surround themselves with great blockers who love the game. You can count on this. Prepare for the person in a negotiation who loves the game. You could decide that the tangle of negative attitudes with a blocker may need to be put on the agenda with this person as baggage. I'm jumping the gun here and will explain this idea further in the next chapter. But always show the blocker respect, even as you're circumventing her carefully guarded territory. I followed the travails of Network Inc., the company that was in deep water with a terribly negotiated contract that they realized they simply couldn't honor. It would have put them out of business. So a new team of negotiators was called in, along with me. One of the first things we learned was that no one with Network knew who the real decision-makers were on the other side. When they found out, they'd never heard of a single one of these individuals. Now that's pretty amazing. As the new team nosed around and asked questions throughout the other company, the same three or four names kept popping up as candidates to be the real decision-maker, but one other name was mentioned by everyone except those in this individual's division. This guy turned out to be where the buck stopped. And in his own division, everyone blocked for him. The first team of negotiators didn't know about him or anyone else of importance. They'd been negotiating with blockers, plain and simple. They'd been dealing with the purchasing office, and the purchasing office should never be in a negotiation. They handle the paperwork and not the decisions. Everyone knows this. The more power the old team gave to purchasing, the less effective they became. Once the new team came in, purchasing was, for all intents and purposes, out of the loop. The second group of blockers that had to be dealt with by the new team were the technical evaluators of the machine in question. The head of this evaluation group had been displaced within his own company, as colleagues had been promoted all around him. He was standing still, didn't have a lot of positive feelings about where things stood. He was very defensive about every decision he had made in the past in the area in question, and he was doing everything he could to defend his decisions. Basic human nature. As it turned out, one of those decisions was responsible for almost $100 million worth of equipment sitting idly at his company. So he had a lot to defend, and the Network deal would make that equipment entirely obsolete. Everyone else in the department was now begging for the Network equipment, while the blocker was working as hard as he could to influence the decision-makers otherwise. When this individual got wind of the fact that the new team from Network had finally found out who the real decision-makers were, he immediately tried to sabotage any meeting between the parties and the obstruction continued apace for the duration of that negotiation. It never hurts to start at the top. You can get around your basic blocker in several ways. A surefire way is simply to start at the top. What happens if you start at the top? The top boots you down the ladder to the blocker. But this is fine because, presumably, you've been introduced into the blocker's territory with a stamp of approval. The blocker knows it's okay to talk to you, and the blocker knows that you know that he is indeed a blocker. Start at the top, and you'll be in a position to report to the top. You have a hall pass to the corner office upstairs. Blockers will therefore treat you with respect. If the CEO had time to talk to you, the blocker has time to talk to you. Or he'd better find the time. But all is not lost if you can't start at the top. You can still deal with the blocker from below. Ring, ring. Hello, this is the office of the President of the United States. Tammy speaking. Tammy, my name is Bill Jones, and I need your help. What are the criteria I must meet to have an audience with the President? Tammy, who would have the ear of the President on matters of supercomputers capable of putting billions of dollars into the Treasury without any additional taxes? Well, I recommend you speak with the Chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Mr. Smith. Tammy, do you know his most competent assistant I might talk to? Why, yes, she's a classmate of mine, Betty. Would you like me to transfer you to her number? I'd appreciate that. Would you be so kind as to tell her why I'm calling? It's very difficult to call out of the blue, as you know. Yes, I'll be glad to do that. Let's see if we can reach her. A fantasy? Yes, but this approach will get you somewhere. Don't just get around the blocker, but also get a useful introduction from the blocker. This is much easier to do when you understand what the blocker is really doing, which is trying to feel okay. Have a little sympathy. Engage in a little nurturing. Bill, I'd like to make a deal with you. I'd like to go over our proposal with you. If what I present to you is not acceptable and you know it won't fly, you just tell me no, it won't fly, and I'll go away. Fair? Fair. Okay, that'll be our deal. If you like what I propose and feel it's what the committee's looking for, all I ask is that you allow me to represent myself to the committee. Fair? What have we done? We've protected our proposal and also protected Bill's okayness. If Bill accepts this proposal, he'll fight for it, or at least strongly support your program to the committee. This approach usually works. If it doesn't, if Bill never allows anyone else to make a proposal to the committee, if he doesn't feel comfortable with you and is afraid the committee won't either and will then blame him, you go to your second choice. Bill, I understand that under no circumstances will anyone but you talk to the committee. All I ask is if you don't like what I show you, just tell me no and I'll get out of your hair. But if you like our proposal and wish to recommend it to the committee, all I ask is that you let me coach you on my proposal and what you might say. Allow me to wait out in the hall just in case there are any questions the committee wants answered. That way, you're protected with adequate information in case something unexpected comes up. Fair? That'll be our deal. What if Bill won't accept this agenda? Go to your third choice for an agenda. Bill, I understand that no one else is to be present during the committee meeting, even in the hall. All I ask is that you allow me to coach you on what to say, and if any question arises, allow me to wait in your office. You can call me there, and I can provide you any information you need. Of course, if you don't like my proposal today, it's okay. You won't hurt my feelings. Just tell me no, and I'll go away. We'll take a shot at working with you next time around. If Bill still balks, unlikely but possible, consult your time and energy budget, because this situation doesn't look promising. How much have you put into this negotiation? Are you fighting too hard? Are you needy? Should you simply walk away, no hard feelings? Whatever your decision, it'll be a good one, because you've retained control of the negotiation. You preserved the blocker's okayness. He's comfortable. You've given him every opportunity to say no. You haven't tried to close him. You've given him every opportunity to create vision. And finally, if you give up on Bill as a lost cause, you can always move in any other direction you like within the organization. The talented negotiator moves freely within the decision process. The talented negotiator enjoys solving the shell game.